All right. Okay, so perhaps that is fortunate that you had, I guess, these, let me just guess it, detailed phylogenetic talks, a variety of models of evolution, neutral and not so neutral, and so on and so forth. I could, if I thought that I had to continue that tradition, I could also present some perhaps more technical analysis of evolution, of gene evolution, genome scale that we have been doing. But my idea for this talk was different, and I thought that I would just present sort of an overview of our thoughts on how the whole universe of protein domains has come to be, starting with the very early stages of evolution. And of course, probably more important than any thoughts, some examples of how specific observations on modern genomes, and particularly proteins encoded in modern genomes, their comparative analysis, helps us to understand something about different stages of evolution, including very early ones, that in my opinion is credible. Could we actually have some of these slides off? Because I think that would be desirable. Of course, the singular most stupid thing I could do, being at this institution, is start to talk physical analogies. So that's exactly what I'm going to do right now. We have a large variety of various protein domains, I'll come to a somewhat closer to formal definition of that, on, I guess, on the next slide. But anyway, these compact units of proteins, protein domains, encoded by all organisms. They all have come from some ancestral state, from some ancestral domain or domains, in some sort of a big bang. At least there is definitely something very similar about the early ideas on very early original stages of the evolution of the universe of the proteins and protein domains with the ideas of modern cosmology at my primitive level of understanding, namely that we don't understand either of those things almost at all. Just showing these slides to emphasize that people have been thinking and talking origin mythologies for thousands of years. And we are doing the same thing at somewhat more specific level with numerous genome sequencing and protein structures at hand. What is a protein domain after all? As I already alluded to, basically this is a compact unit of protein structure that shows persistence in that shows particular topological pattern of secondary structure elements, or alpha helices and beta strands, like here. These things are called strands, and these things are evidently helices. Each distinct structure of a protein domain, which is usually called fold, has a distinct topology of these elements. Since I'm talking today about evolution, about what I called phylogenomics of protein domains, that is, evolution of protein domains in the genomic context, if you will, or evolution of protein domains understood from the viewpoint of genome comparisons, it will serve me just as well to say right off the bat that I strongly believe that any time you have a common unit like this, a common fold in a certain set of protein domains, This indicates a monophyletic, as they say in evolutionary biology, or common origin of all these domains. Well, the question emerges, of course, why? And this is not really something that I can prove within the type of analysis we are talking about here, which deals with comparison of protein sequences and structures. I do think, however, that there are strong indications that this is true. Well, perhaps the strongest indication is actually very simple, and is the following. We have plenty of situations, plenty of evidence, when one particular biochemical reaction will come down the road during today's talk to a couple of such examples. One particular biochemical reaction is catalyzed by two completely unrelated domains, by domains that have completely different folds. Therefore, it appears that whenever you see a conservation of such fold, this is not caused by functional constraints, but rather by common history, by origin from the same ancestral domains. At a, if you will, a more intuitive level, what rather convinces us that that the conservation of a protein fold is evidence of a common origin is the fact that when we study any family of protein domains, and this is what we do for a living, basically. People like myself and those who work in my group do that for a living. We, for various purposes, some of which we will discuss, we compare sequences and structures of proteins and protein domains every day, sometimes on a large scale. And whenever we do that, what we see is this kind of gradient of relations or the level of relationships, level of similarity between these domains. Here I just showed a schematic rough tree, which I believe reflects the evolutionary history for a particular class of domains. I will not bother you with the details of these domains. These are basically signaling domains, some of which like these path domains, so I'm bothering you with the details of that. Like these path domains are responsible for signal transduction that is necessary for all biological clocks in the human body, for example, just to make it a little bit practical. But what I want to say here, what I want to emphasize for you here, is that we see this gradient of similarity, gradient of relationship, whereby at the leaves of such a tree, we have very, very similar sequences. When we have what we call orthologs, the direct counterparts, proteins that are direct evolutionary counterparts in different proteins, usually these display a high level of sequence similarity between each other, even between orthologs, say, between humans and bacteria at this kind of evolutionary distance, usually show absolutely indisputable, highly significant sequence similarity to each other. However, when we move down from the leaves of such a tree to the hypothetical root, what we notice is a gradually diminishing level of similarity. And this, of course, corresponds to get a little bit technical for a second, this corresponds to a gradient of methods that one needs to apply. And at this level, straightforward sequence comparisons such as the popular BLAST program work very well. Down here, when you are comparing two related domains, you have to apply, you also can get by nicely with sequence comparison methods, but these methods must become more sophisticated. You need to apply so-called profile methods, where, in which you extract information from multiple alignments of many sequences of these domains, and this helps you making these searches more sensitive. And down here, when you are comparing more distantly related domains, what you believe are more distantly related domains, you need to apply already structural comparisons. And this kind of gradient is observed in for each of domains that have such a common fold. And since it's absolutely indisputable that at levels like this, there is an evolutionary relationship, we tend to believe that the entire gradient corresponds to an even more ancient divergence.
If you want to put this tree, if you want to put some time scale on this tree, because this will be much, much beyond the sort of the kind of limit.
Well, if you want to, we'll actually, if I manage to go through 50% or so of my prepared talk, we will come to some specific time scale, not so much in terms of years, actually even in terms of years, but particularly in terms of certain biological transitions in evolution. We will come to a time scale. But why not put it here? I'm not entirely sure for this domain, for this particular class of domains. For quite many, we clearly go far beyond the last universal common ancestor of all living things observed today, and even fairly deep into the hypothetical RNA world, where things really were done in a way quite different from the way they're done in modern cells. I will talk about that a little bit later. Okay, so since I don't really hope to get to the, I hope you ask more questions, so I don't really hope to get to the end of my talk today, I'll just lay out some general principles of what I call protein phylogenomics in lieu of conclusions. And then we'll, in the subsequent slides and discussion, we'll try to basically illustrate these things. Firstly, what I already spent some time talking about, a very fundamental fact. In reality, the fact that allows us to extract anything useful at all from these kinds of comparisons is that protein domains show extreme evolutionary conservation in terms of conserved sequences and more so in terms of conserved structures. And this allows us to obtain some reconstructions of the protein and domain repertoire of the last universal common ancestor, and even, as I just said, go beyond and probably all the way to the so-called RNA world. The other side of the coin, however, is that protein domain architectures, that is, arrangement of different domains in a protein, and many proteins have two, three more distinct domains joined consecutively. So these protein domain architectures are much less conserved, and shuffling of domains is a major evolutionary phenomenon, and what we call accretion of domains, accumulation of additional domains in an autologous group of proteins, is an important force behind the increase in the complexity of organisms, eukaryotes in particular. Furthermore, genome comparisons tend to change significantly our views of evolution. And making our picture of biological evolution more complex and more dynamic than it used to be. And in particular, it appears that horizontal gene transfer is all too common between sometimes very, very distant organisms, is all too common in evolution and contributes even to the emergence and evolution of what may be called essential biological systems. From the evolutionary conservation of protein domains, it pretty much follows that emergence of a new domain is really a major innovation, a major evolutionary event. However, this being said, many new domains were, so to speak, invented at early stages of the evolution of eukaryotes. And we can track down particular mechanisms, particular phenomena that contribute to this emergence of new domains. And finally, lineage-specific expansion of gene families, duplication of diversification within specific evolutionary lineages, is another major force of evolution. We'll try, in the rest of my talk, to illustrate each of these points.
Can you give us an idea of how many new domains have been invented in the last 100 million years?
How many new domains have been invented?
Yeah.
In the evolution of eukaryotes?
Yeah.
Actually, if we come to that, the total number of distinct domain folds that seem to exist is not a huge number. It is number on the order of 1,000, of let's say 1,000, to be very lax, very humble in our ability to estimate that, between 1,000 and 2,000. And of these, perhaps 25% or so, roughly, have been invented by eukaryotes. Very rough estimate, but not very far. Okay. So before I go and talk about specific inferences that we make, I would like to introduce some notion that I consider to be really very important. And that is the notion of phyletic distribution. We are now of proteins, domains. In principle, you can, of course, apply that even to functional systems, to many different things. But above all, we are talking about protein domains and protein domain and proteins, or in other words, protein domain architectures. So a phyletic distribution is simply a pattern of presence or absence of a particular domain or a particular combination of domains in different evolutionary lineages. Now, of course, I think you realize immediately that we can talk about absences, or we could talk about presence of a particular domain or a particular protein in different species for a very long time. But only now, with the availability of a significant number of complete genome sequences, does it make sense to talk about absence. And therefore, this whole notion starts to make sense and allows us to make, in a probabilistic way, of course, a variety of sometimes important evolutionary inferences. In particular, if a given domain is present in all major lineages of life forms, the most natural conclusion is that this domain is a direct inheritance from the last universal common ancestor of life. Of course, if you recall some points that I made on the previous slides, you may say that this may not be true because actually such a pattern could have evolved through horizontal gene transfer, through promiscuous dissemination of a particular type of proteins and domains through all walks of life. And you may not be even too wrong about that. This might happen, but if something is really, really universal, of course, the likelihood of such a pervasive horizontal dissemination is not particularly high, And furthermore, of course, the notion of origin from the last universal common ancestor can be supported by a particular type of phylogenetic tree topology for a given protein or domain. For example, when we see what can be called a standard model of evolution, whereby bacteria and archaea and bacteria form one major branch of the tree, whereas archaea and eukaryotes form the other. We'll see such trees later on. It has to be kept in mind that some uniformity in phyletic patterns is indeed brought about by lateral gene transfer, whereas gene loss results in more sparse phyletic patterns. We can make a variety of more specific conclusions. For example, if we see, we can conclude on ancestral origin if something, some domain or some combination of domains is ubiquitous. But if it is not, if it is limited in its phyletic distribution to one particular branch of the tree, say some domain is found exclusively in bacteria or exclusively in eukaryotes, we can make, again, probabilistic but strong conclusion on its invention concomitant to a certain transition in evolution with the birth of this particular branch. And the same kinds of conclusions on directional derivation of particular forms of domains can be made more specifically. Off the cuff calculations.
Have the prokaryotes been also created, or is it maybe less created?
Well, in a sense, prokaryotes come from this very point. So, and the first divergence, let's say, the first major radiation in the history of life has been between two branches of prokaryotes. So in a sense, everything has been invented in prokaryotes. Everything else has been invented in prokaryotes. Okay, but what you probably really mean is the inventiveness in particular lineages of bacteria. And from what I can conclude, these have been less elaborate in inventing really new domains. But some, say actinomycetes or some other bacteria with complex signal transduction system, have been quite good in inventing new domain combinations. And of course, in the prokaryotic world, whatever is invented tends to be disseminated horizontally. Speaking of what I would like to do now is to become a little bit more practical for a moment and to tell you a few words about a system of evolutionary classification of proteins from completely sequenced genomes that we have developed, and that is available for use at the NCBI website. We call these families that comprise this evolutionary classification of proteins from sequenced genomes clusters of orthogous groups of proteins. And I need to emphasize again two things here. I'm not going to get into the details of the methods here. The way we try to construct these groups is such that we are trying to identify direct evolutionary counterparts, or orthologs. That's why orthologs, why groups? Because these orthologs, these direct orthologs relationships are not necessarily one-to-one relationships. It is lineage specific expansions, as I already mentioned, are common in evolution of many gene families, and therefore it's also common that a whole set of so-called paralogs that evolve as a result of gene duplication in one lineage corresponds to just one gene in another lineage, hence groups. So right now we have about 3,000, some more than 3,000 of these families of orthologs from about 50 genomes, and so considerable statistics can be done on genomes in these families. And some simple breakdown of this database of orthologous families allows us, I think, to arrive to significant conclusions. So what I want to emphasize here is something important to note, I think, namely that in pretty much all simple prokaryotic genomes, a good majority of the proteins encoded in the genome actually belong to these clusters of orthologs. And since in this analysis, very close organisms have not been treated separately, they have been included as one entity, each of these families represents an ancient concert family, a family that is that has been persistent in evolution for a very considerable time. So in the smaller genomes of free living bacteria, Aquifex here for example, or Thermatoga, or parasitic bacteria like here, up to 85% of the proteins belong to such ancient families. This fraction is somewhat lower in the larger prokaryotic genomes, and for the moment this system on which these statistics have been done includes only one eukaryotic genome, that of the yeast S. cerevisiae, and of course, perhaps predictably here, this fraction is much lower. The fraction of the proteins, let me emphasize this, that is shared with prokaryotes is much lower, only about one-third of the entire set of proteins, which suggests that actually quite a few eukaryote-specific cogs exist, and we are working on that right now. But the principal conclusion that I wanted to make here is that the majority of the proteins, at least in these simple genomes, actually show remarkable evolutionary conservation. Probably the yeast genome has gone through a relatively recent duplication indeed, but I don't think this is particularly relevant. Firstly, the remnants of this duplication are not so much. Most of these genes have been, on most occasions, one of the two copies have been. No, no, not really, because there aren't that many remnants of this duplication. Actually, in each pair of these paralogs, pretty much one has been lost. There enough remains to figure out that this duplication happens, but it's really not a huge number, firstly. Secondly, if anything, if that duplication happened last week and each protein in the yeast genome had its twin, then probably that would only increase the fraction of the genome that belong to these families.
We would count only one of the two twins.
No, we would count both. We would include both. And as I tried to emphasize on one of the previous slides, these families have the tendency to include more than one protein from different genomes, particularly those that have diverged recently. So, yeah. So I don't think this, in this particular case, is relevant. But when you look at these same families in a different way, you see evidence of something significantly different. So this is a somewhat outdated slide, but the trend certainly persists, and if anything, is becoming more and more striking. And this trend is that only a tiny, only a very small fraction of these conserved families of orthologs is represented in all included genomes. About 5% and going down, because as new genomes are accumulated, more exceptions are found. In contrast, for the majority of families only includes a small number of genomes, 3, 4, 5 genomes. So while the majority of the proteins in each genome belong to ancient conserved families, these families themselves tend to show patterns of scattered distribution among the genomes. I think this observation alone, realistically speaking, tells us that horizontal gene transfer, as well as lineage-specific gene loss, have been major contributions to genome evolution. Actually, the role of horizontal gene transfer is sometimes rather, as well as gene loss actually, to a somewhat lesser extent, are sometimes hotly debated, but in reality I think that this prevalent tendency that we see among these families to be represented in only a small number of a small fraction of the available genomes, so in a sense puts these disputes to rest. These processes clearly have to a large extent shaped the gene composition of the genomes as we see it.
How would you distinguish between something that has originated in horizontal transfer in different kingdoms, say, and something that is due to the last components? Is there?
Well, as I said, that can be done, or on the basis of the analysis of phyletic distributions, as well as the level of similarity between proteins and the topology of phylogenetic trees. If something is, all explanations in this business are based on the parsimony principle. Basically, the only thing you can conclude is that the most parsimonious scenario for the evolution of a particular gene family, a particular system, and so on and so forth, is this. For example, that it comes from the last universal common ancestor. Or, on the contrary, that it has been largely disseminated by horizontal gene transfer or by differential gene loss. You cannot conclude that absolutely, but actually, since we have many of these families, if you just come up with the idea that all of them, even those that are found in only a few genomes, go back down to the last universal common ancestor, you will you'll be forced to postulate a complexity of that last universal common ancestor considerably greater than the complexity of most modern genomes. Yes?
In the same slide, the domains rather than whole proteins, have you done the same distribution for domains, and the most domains are universal?
With domains, the picture is this is a very detailed picture, and I have not really done such a picture for domains. Of course, the fraction of domains that are found in all or the majority of organisms is greater than for individual orthologs, evidently. Or when you go to finer granularity of whole proteins, you see more scatter. Although, as we already discussed, there are quite a few lineage-specific domains. So basically, we can make these probabilistic conclusions based on the distribution of these domains and proteins among organisms as well as the observed level of similarities and the topology of phylogenetic trees. Based on all of this, one can come up with the most parsimonious evolutionary scenarios explaining the observed patterns. And this is, for all I know, the best one can do in terms of understanding evolution. If parsimony is significantly violated, then, of course, you can explain, in principle, you can explain any patterns that you observe by horizontal gene transfer, for example. But you have to postulate an enormous number of these events.
But can you comment like how the horizontal transfer is integrated into that scheme of parsimony? Because I could, I mean, these are rather rare, or maybe not so rare events, but it certainly needs some weighing of a probability of, say, a horizontal transfer versus just coming from down the tree somewhere. So that there is there has to be some kind of way of,
in terms of,
if you want to make a conclusion between, say, horizontal transfer versus coming from the common ancestor.
The following. When you are talking about coming from the common ancestor, or even the very possibility of such explanations, what you are assuming is widespread lineage-specific gene loss, right? Because otherwise, it cannot be explained otherwise. The observed distributions of the genomes by these gene families cannot be explained otherwise. So basically, what you are talking about, and rightly so, is the relative probability of gene loss compared to that of horizontal transfer. Right? So that is indeed a very basic question, at least to which we don't have a good answer. Without a good answer, for prokaryotic genomes at least, I'm inclined to accept equal probabilities. Because by no means is horizontal transfer a rare event in these genomes. It's very common for us to see a particular protein with a unique domain architecture to be found in very distant branches of the bacterial world, or to be shared by a particular branch of bacteria and a particular branch of eukaryotes, and so on and so forth. We don't have really a good specific way to estimate these relative likelihoods of these different types of events. And in the absence of a specific way, I'm inclined to give them actually equal weight. So, I wanted to have some glimpses into early evolution of life and again use the phyletic distribution approach to do so. And in order to get a handle of that, let's have a look at this standard model tree, whereby the divergence between bacteria and the common ancestor of archaea and eukaryotes is the first major bifurcation in the evolution of life, followed by the divergence of archaea and eukaryota, and of course, including a variety of subsequent radiations. So there are, not unexpectedly, there are many important proteins and whole functional systems that are shared by throughout this tree by all or the great majority of lineages, and therefore are with high probability traceable to the last universal common ancestor. Above all, these include various components of the translation machinery, the ribosome itself, associated enzymes of RNA processing and RNA modifications such as pseudosynthases, RNA metallases, and others, amino acid tRNA synthetases, and so on, a variety of translation factors, and as well as components of the transcription machinery, RNA polymerase, subunits, and some others, and also certain molecular chaperones and certain isolated components of the DNA replication system, and of course, ribosomal and transfer RNAs themselves. All this is, perhaps not unexpectedly, traceable to the last universal common ancestor of all life forms. Most unexpectedly, however, some very important, central enzymes of all extant living cells show a very different phyletic patterns. And first of all, these are the components of DNA replication machinery, such as DNA polymerases themselves, primases, replicative helicases, origin recognition complexes, and other indispensable essential parts of the DNA replication machineries. These are completely different, and with all the detailed analysis that we and others have performed, apparently unrelated in these two major branches of life. The most straightforward and probable comparison from this is actually that the last universal common ancestor was an organism significantly unlike all the cells that we know nowadays. Namely, that it was a, at least partly an RNA-based organism with an RNA genome and without DNA replication as we know it. Although some functions related to DNA probably had already developed according to our model, at least, it's likely that the last universal common ancestor had a replication cycle not very much unlike that of modern retroviruses, which included reverse transcription of RNA into of RNA genomes into DNA with subsequent back transcription, hence the presence of the transcription machinery from this point already. So the almost inevitable conclusion is that the last universal common ancestor was pretty much an RNA-based, an RNA-centered organism. We also know that as a result of a variety of very ingenious experiments, that ribozymes, RNA enzymes, are capable of catalyzing a number of different enzymatic reactions. From this, it's of course, again, almost inevitable that some sort of RNA-based world has preceded the last universal common ancestor. So now the question is, can we look at all back into this RNA world? And it seems like, basically, we can. Here I would like to make another little interlude and introduce another project that we are working on, which is directed at a more or less complete evolutionary classification of all protein domains, which goes from the secondary structure classes of proteins on top to superfolds, which show general patterns of structural similarity to folds, and down through a variety of classification levels to terminal leaves that represent individual autologous proteins. We are trying to slowly develop such a classification by detailed analysis of all protein folds, and I'll show you some glimpses of that. For that purpose, let's look at such a schematic of classification scheme of one of the most widespread protein domains in nature, the so-called P-loop and TPase, which is an extremely common enzymatic domain, a domain found in 10 to 20% of all proteins encoded by each genome, maybe a little bit less in eukaryotic genomes, but at that level in prokaryotic genomes, a domain that is responsible for hydrolysis of ATP and GTP, which is coupled to an extremely wide variety of biological processes. So basically, through structural comparisons and some very general sequence signatures, this whole fold can be classified into three classes, one of which includes helicases, transport and DNA repair, ATPases, as well as proton ATPases responsible for energetic energy metabolism. The other one includes primarily small molecule kinases, and the third one includes GTPases and related proteins. And this classification can be traced further down to or up to specific clusters of orthologs that we discussed before. So basically, at the basis of this leaf from this book of protein classification is a fold, and the leaves are those cogs that we discussed before. And let's look in some greater detail into one of those large classes. Okay, I'm not going to talk in great detail, although I guess probably could, about each of these families. I just want to give you some specific points here, or point you to some specific conclusions. The most important of which is the following. Through a detailed analysis of these, or of the distribution of various families within this particular protein fold, we can trace about 10 protein superfamilies that are universal or almost universal in nature back to the last universal common ancestor. An inevitable conclusion from this, since we pretty much agreed that all these domains come from the same, originally come from the same ancestor. So an inevitable conclusion is that a considerable history of divergence with many duplications preceded the stage of the last universal common ancestor. Another important conclusion that we must make here is that most of these proteins have to do with various manipulations made with nucleic acids, either translation or RNA unwinding in the process of translation and or transcription or recombination or repair or some other processes, a variety of nucleic acid caput or manipulations. Yes. Oh, well, that's the most interesting question. From the from the phylogenetic distribution of REC A and from the topology of the tree, we must conclude that it was right there. On the other hand, and so was, by the way, DNA dependent, at least the main subunits of DNA-dependent RNA polymerases. On the other hand, apparently, DNA-dependent DNA polymerases were not there. So I think the best model to explain this is sort of a reverse transcription model that postulates an RNA genome, or basically a genome that consists of a collection of RNA segments with a DNA replication intermediate. So the RNA genome is transcribed into DNA, reverse transcribed into DNA, whereas this DNA is transcribed back into RNA, not unlike the modern retroviruses.
It's still RNA getting to the ribosome. So why not have DNA in this organism?
Why not what?
What is DNA doing in this organism?
As I said, I think that the best model to reconstruct this organism is one in which DNA is formed as a replication intermediate. That is, apparently from a purely RNA-based system, where there is simply no DNA, the transition goes into a system where RNA is replicated through a DNA intermediate. And that is the stage of this last universal common ancestors, as we can conclude from these distributions of various components. So I suppose that what REC A is doing there is some form of processing of these DNA intermediates. And some other DNA-related proteins, such as, for example, sliding clamps and clamp rotors, I suppose, have been also involved in that process. This is the best I can propose, because, as I said, the replication systems themselves are not traceable to the last universal common ancestor. Of course, in principle, one can come up with models of replacement of the replication systems in particular lineages. But then you are really faced with a difficult need to explain where the alternative system for replication comes from.
Is this a very important influence about the role of DNA? Just to clarify, that this is based on what you see, that the DNA polymerase in eukaryotes and prokaryotes are sort of
all of them have DNA polymerases. The point in case is that archaea and eukaryotes have one kind of DNA polymerase, one kind of replication helicase, and some other important DNA ligase, and some other important enzymes involved in replication, whereas bacteria have completely different ones that In the very beginning, when they started talking about common origin of protein domains, they said that there are good examples of enzymes that have completely different structures but do the same thing. So that is one of the strongest. Yeah.
Could it be that LUCA at all didn't have anything to do with DNA, and BRCA, for example, could serve for RNA duplexes?
Imaginable. I suppose still a difficult proposition, particularly because of the existence of the. Of the traceability of the DNA-dependent RNA polymerase to that LUCA. You may say, of course, that also had to do with RNA replication. But actually, again, I'm not inclined to believe this because there's very high conservation, and if you can reconstruct that enzyme, it's after all not so different from what we see today. So I don't think so. You see, quite definitely, all this has come from a completely RNA-based organism. So the question is basically, the question is mapping those evolutionary transitions. And from what we can see, it would be quite nice to conclude that this LUCA had nothing to do with DNA, but I don't think that from what we can see in terms of the distribution of different enzymes, this is the best explanation. So anyhow, the conclusions that I wanted to leave you with here are firstly, that quite many families are traceable to the lost universal common ancestor. And the inference of this, the obvious inference from this, is that there was significant preceding evolution. And another conclusion that I wanted to make was that since then there was repeated derivation of different function, repeated directional derivation of different function in distinct evolutionary lineages. For example, sequence comparisons and trees clearly show that the replicative DNA helicase of bacteria, the so-called DNA B protein, has evolved from RAC A. This protein, these are the two closest relatives in this whole part of the universe occupied by these ATPases. And DNA B is found only in bacteria with some horizontal transfers into eukaryotes, whereas RAC A is universal. So the direction of derivation is quite clear here. And a similar thing, although the function is very different, and a similar, even more striking example perhaps, is the derivation of the transcription termination factor Rho in bacteria from the universal proton ATPase. And a variety of such things happened repeatedly in evolution, leading to adaptation of these domains to many different functions.
In a pre-LUCA phase, why should there be a common ancestor for all the proteins? Where originally there could be a number, I could easily imagine 20 different types of polypeptides that separate.
Very possibly, but we are not talking about all proteins. We are talking about a very distinct type of domain. Such possibility exists. We are talking in this case about a very particular type of domain that, for us to be confident, even has very particular sequence signatures that are conserved throughout this vast protein class.
But isn't, like, when we talk about the pre-LUCA phase, we're still thinking of a tree in this diagram?
Oh, yes, and for a very precise reason. Because a clear hierarchy of this relationship can be deciphered. These two families are very clearly related to each other. You can reproduce that yourself running database searches, and if you wish, making trees and whatever. And the same is The same is true for other superfamilies. So, yes, they are thinking in terms of a tree because they are observing such an hierarchy of relationships at sequence and structural levels.
Did you notice the exact people you showed?
I could draw it on the blackboard if you wish. Well, I can draw it on the blackboard. It's this kind of thing. It's a beta strand, a hydrophobic beta strand. The G residue here. The this signature here. And then an alpha helix over there. This is a consensus, this is the most common form. But structurally, it's a very flexible, practically always glycine-rich loops that sort of wraps around the triphosphate tail of ATP or GTP.
And the size of the thing?
The size of the thing is very, very, very clear from this. It's what? 8 residues here, another 5 residues for this strand. And another 7 residues for this helix.
So about 30.
Oh, yeah. Oh, compatible, don't worry.
No, I didn't mean that.
Compatible with a closed loop, like many other things. Of course, this is only a part of a particular alpha-beta domain. There are other elements of that domain formed primarily with a parallel beta sheet with alpha helix decoration that is conserved in all of these proteins.
This is beta-beta and an alpha.
Oh, well, in this case it's a beta loop alpha, another parallel beta, another alpha, another parallel beta, like that. Now these questions make me ask a question myself. Can you bear with me further, or do we need a break or whatever? I don't know. Oh, depends on how far I go. If I go through everything that I wanted to say, I probably would have to speak maybe for another 45, 50 minutes. If I'm a little bit more humane and want to stop a little bit early, which is likely, then half an hour could be sufficient. I don't know. It's really your choice. Yeah, I mostly speak in various kinds of biology-oriented departments. And in those departments, you are lost if you speak for 65 minutes. So I'm not used to that, although I do enjoy it. So it's your choice.
So would this be a good point for short
break? To me, it's okay. To me, it's all right. All right, so let's proceed with some more of these reconstructions. In the very beginning, when Terry asked a question, I promised to say something about the time scale, about our ability to go back to specific points in evolution, to points that mark specific evolutionary transitions. And I'm going to discuss just that now. For that purpose, I will consider the evolutionary history of a particular protein domain as it emerges from a variety of sequence and structural comparisons. A little biological background here. I suppose most of you know what are amino acyl tRNA synthetases. But just in order to put us all on the same wave, these are the enzymes that couple amino acids to tRNAs during protein synthesis, and that are accordingly indispensable for protein synthesis, at least in any modern cell. And of course, I guess most of you can guess how many amino acid tRNA synthetases exist altogether. How many? Sorry? It is. Don't get too sophisticated. 20 is the answer. There are some little tricks to that, and I'm not saying that every organism has 20. But altogether, there are 20 types, 20 specificities. And interestingly enough, this is one other example of a situation. I'm trying to, as we go, I'm trying to accumulate these examples. This is one other example of a situation where two very different types of domains do pretty much the same thing. Not exactly the same, because they do it for different amino acids, but the same type of reaction. So there are two apparently unrelated classes of amino acid tRNA synthetases. One of these, the so-called high class, because it contains this particular sequence signature, which is shown here for tyrosyl tRNA synthetase, comprises half of all tRNA synthetases. We're neatly divided 10 and 10 into these two classes. So all of these in this class are, for all we know, monophyletic and actually are easily unifiable at the sequence level. But there is actually more to the story, because what can be done is also showing the common origin of amino acid, this class, particular class of amino acid tRNA synthetases, and a particular family of small molecule nucleotide transferases that participate in the synthesis of bacterial cell wall and other processes, and even contain very similar sequence signatures. Furthermore, this can be done quite confidently at the sequence level. Furthermore, through structural comparisons, we now can extend this relationship to an even larger class of nucleotide utilizing enzymes, such as the so-called USP family, or a rather mysterious group of small nucleotide binding enzymes and nucleotide binding hydrolyzing enzymes that function in stress response and other things, but are not really understood in functional terms, photolyases that function in DNA repair, and so-called electron transport flavor proteins that function in energy conversion. Through structural comparisons, we can show that they all have the same domain structure, the same fold. Two of these folds are shown here, and we can produce a structural alignment that even reveals some level of sequence similarity. So this sort of unification of all these different enzymes. Okay, and you missed some. Oh, okay, you missed the introduction to this part, but you should be able to understand with it well, to understand it without any difficulty. Yeah, go ahead.
What out of 10?
Go ahead.
Sure.
I'm sorry?
What out of 10 synthetases, these are the tRNA of what?
Of which amino acids?
Yes.
Oh, well, let's.
I mean, is there any pattern to.
Oh, I. Well, There is a curious pattern to that, which goes roughly this way. If you have two similar amino acids, say lysine and arginine, the lysine, the situation is very difficult. Nevertheless, say arginine is class 2, that is not this one. Lysine, on the other hand, the most... Actually, lysine has both class 1 and class 2. But anyhow, if you have two similar amino acids, one will be class 1, one will be class 2. Not strictly, but there is this kind of trend. So the inferences that can be drawn from these types of comparisons are very dramatic if we stop for a moment and think about them. Because it's quite evident that this last universal common ancestor already contained, if not all 10, then at least 9. There are some peculiarities in the distribution of these amino acid tRNA synthetases into which I will not go, but which makes us think that perhaps it was not 10, but 9 of these that have been already present in this last universal common ancestor. So, the duplication of these, the serial duplication of these, has already preceded this last universal common ancestor. But we already agreed that these other nucleotide transferases are basically homologs of the nucleotide transferase domain of these tRNA synthetases. So this duplication here occurred even earlier than all these duplications. And furthermore, while this is traceable also only at the structural level, apparently there were even more ancient duplications that occurred somewhere here to separate this subclass with a particular mode of nucleotide binding from this one with a different mode of nucleotide binding. So what we must conclude here is that a long history of protein domain diversification through duplication and mutational change occurred more or less in the RNA world, because before all these duplications happened, this was not really today's translation system. It was a different translation system that was much more in which RNA was much more important than it is today, was responsible for a greater variety of functions, in particular for the specificity of amino acid activation. What is even more striking than this is that at the time when these duplications happened, apparently there wasn't even really such a thing as amino acid tRNA synthetase at all. So that perhaps some very general nucleotide transferase that participated in both in translation and in some other processes and somehow facilitated amino acid activation, but nothing like the present-day amino acid tRNA synthetases. So what we must conclude is that major diversification of protein domains occurred pretty much not only pre-Luca, but already in the confines of the RNA world itself. Completely different origin from for all I know, I'm trying to think. I haven't studied it in such a detail. I think there are some metabolic enzymes that are related to the nucleotide binding. Absolutely unrelated to this high class, for sure. Completely different structure. Perhaps similar relationships can be deciphered for that other class. I can tell you. Nucleotide binding domain of the other class of amino acid tRNA synthetases is related to the nucleotide binding domain of biotin synthetase, coenzyme biosynthesis enzyme. Similar trace back can be done for the other class of amino acid tRNA synthetases, reinforcing this conclusion, or that significant protein evolution already happened in the RNA bound itself before on the modern type translation system was fixed in evolution.
Eugene?
Yes.
Could you make a simple estimate of about 4,000 proteins in E. coli? How many would contain at least one nucleotide binding domain of this or another kind?
On the order of 25% to 30% of all proteins. My quick estimate.
All right.
Some more than 1,000. Some more than that. So P loop NTPases only, the class that I was talking about before, comprise about 10% of the proteins. This is the largest class, admittedly. But then, other large protein classes, such as the Rossmann-Fold enzymes, perhaps twice smaller or so. And there is a tail of the distribution. So I believe altogether it amounts to about 1/3 of the proteins. Let's talk a little bit more about the junction between protein and RNA bonds. And in order to do so, let's consider two types of RNases, enzymes that catalyze hydrolysis of RNA. One is so-called RNase P. RNase P is basically a modern ribosome. That is an enzyme that uses a piece of RNA, a specific piece of RNA, as its catalytic moiety, but also has a RNA binding domain of a particular kind that stabilizes this catalytic moiety and without which the reaction is inefficient. And the other thing is RNA, so-called RNase pH, which is a garden variety protein enzyme, if you will. However, it can be easily shown that this protein enzyme has the same type of RNA binding domain. So essentially, we can come up with the following scenario for the transition from RNA-based catalysis, involves protein as a structural scaffold, to modern type protein catalysis. It all starts with the ribosome combined with the RNA binding domain. And proceeds with the accretion of these two distinct structural units that together comprise the catalytic domain of RNAs, pH, and supply these catalytic residues, which make the catalysis more efficient than it is with the ribosome, and essentially displace the ribosome, making it obsolete. Hence, the path of transition between RNA and protein worlds. One of the paths of transition, of course. So to give you a little summary of the evolutionary provenance of different protein domains, just to roughly present the fraction of the protein families that belong to each of these fold classes that are traceable to the last universal common ancestor, and those that are of more recent derivation. So basically, we see the whole spectrum here from this class of P-loop ATPases, in which more than half appear to come from the last universal common ancestor. So in a sense, you may say that most of the diversification of this domain class occurred prior to the emergence of this LUCA to other enzymatic domains that are whose diversity is almost as ancient, to binding domains that participate in various forms of regulation and signal transduction that, in principle, are traceable to last universal common ancestor, but most of their diversity is not, and finally, to other types of signal transduction domains that have been derived as independent entities within specific evolutionary lineages, particularly eukaryotes. And at this point, it could be appropriate to talk a little bit about the different paths of evolutionary innovation, particularly those in eukaryotes, and to have an idea of these paths, we analyzed in particular the set of proteins that universal and lineage specific that are involved in translation, initiation, and regulation in eukaryotes. Many of these proteins appear to be eukaryote specific, and what we noticed here is that almost each domain that seems to have been derived after the or within the eukaryotes is an O-alpha domain, a domain that consists of alpha helices only. Like this domain that we sort of discovered in the course of this analysis, and this domain, and others. So this and other analysis lead to generalization of the following kind, that one of the principal sources of domain innovation in the evolution of eukaryotes is the exploitation of the non-specific alpha helical context, in particular exploitation of so-called cold coil domains, which are indeed non-specific alpha helical domains, to derive specific, to freeze these long cold coil structures in specific configurations through interruptions in the helical pattern, and thus produce distinct O alpha fold. And we see this complex O alpha fold indeed in a variety of signal transduction domains that are critical in different eukaryotic systems. Alternatively, these helical units may grow by duplication and produce alpha superhelical scaffolds that are also very typical of protein-protein interaction domains that are important in eukaryotes. Another manner by which new domains can be produced can be illustrated by the so-called plextrin homology domain that appears to have evolved through marriage of two different beta strand, O beta, not necessarily all beta, but primarily beta sheet domains between which this ligand binding pocket is located. Each of these domains per se is ancient, is found in many versions, both in prokaryotes and eukaryotes. But this combination that results in the pH domain is new and apparently has evolved on the onset of eukaryotic evolution. By comparison of different domain families, it seems like we now can come up with certain important avenues for protein innovation that contributed to the origin of the eukaryotic cell itself.
At the genomic level, it's just random marriage. Is there something that tells, say that this is domain here, and this is sort of this mix and matching by just pretty random shuffling?
You see, I suppose in that sense it's not different from any evolutionary events. Yes, it happens by random shuffling, but then something good comes out of it. It's fixed in evolution, like in this case. For all I understand. So I guess the final thing that I would like to briefly discuss is the contribution of horizontal gene transfer combined with what Stephen Jay Gould and we have taken called exaptation, that is recruitment of particular domains or proteins for completely different new functions to evolution in general and evolution of eukaryotes in particular. So this slide, we show the phylogenetic tree for an amino acid tRNA synthetase. However, not one of the high class, but one of the other class, the glycyl tRNA synthetase. So, interestingly enough, this particular branch here that includes only animal proteins corresponds to a protein that in its function is not an amino acid tRNA synthetase, but rather, very unexpectedly, a subunit of mitochondrial DNA DNA polymerase. Not the subunit that is responsible for catalysis itself, but rather the regulatory subunit that increases the processivity of the enzymes. However, it can be rather easily shown by sequence analysis, and of course it's fully confirmed by the structure that has been recently determined, that this DNA polymerase subunit actually has been derived from glycyl amino acid tRNA synthetase. This is unexpected in itself, but what is perhaps even more unexpected is that when we build this phylogenetic tree, which is strongly supported by bootstrap analysis, by maximum likelihood analysis, and by whatever statistical procedure you try to apply, these DNA polymerase subunits actually group not with eukaryotic glycyl tRNA synthetase, which are right here, but rather with a particular branch of bacterial glycyl tRNA synthetases. The so-called Deinococcus thermus group. To be completely sure that this is indeed the evolutionary origin of these eukaryotic proteins, we can look at the domain architecture of different branches of glycyl tRNA synthetases in this tree and see that in this case there is a distinct shared derived character, as we call it, as evolutionary biologists call it, a synapomorphy, namely a unique insert within the catalytic domain of glycyl tRNA synthetase, which is shared by archaeal and eukaryotic enzymes, but not by this group of bacterial enzymes with which these DNA polymerase subunits group. What we see here is, I think, is very strong evidence for horizontal acquisition by eukaryotes of a gene encoding a particular enzyme from a particular branch of bacteria with concomitant change of the function. Another important source of evolutionary innovation. However, I don't think so, because these particular bacteria are very distant from the ancestors of mitochondria. Furthermore, the bacteria that are close to the ancestors of mitochondria encode a very different kind of glycyl tRNA synthetase, which cannot be even placed in this tree. It's so different that it's related, but it's very, very distant. You cannot even make a good sequence alignment, so you cannot even include it in this tree. So, to generalize a little bit on this issue, let me show you a few more phylogenetic trees for amino acid tRNA synthetase. I speak so much about these because these are really good model systems to study evolution. So this tree for the leucine tRNA synthetase represents, to our relief, what may be called the standard model. This very long internal edge separates the archaea eukaryotic group and the bacterial group that rather nicely also includes eukaryotic mitochondrial proteins. But this is of the 20, if I recall correctly, we analyzed this in no detail, the data is just not in front of me, but I think I'm not mistaken if I say that in its pure form, the standard model is seen for only 3 of the 20 amino acid tRNA synthetase. So it's not even so typical, although it is the most parsimonious basic model underlying these trees. This guy? That's a tough question to me. I don't really think not, but I don't quite remember, I must say. So even somewhat more typically, what you see is something like this. Then this internal branch, long, confidently determined internal edge on which you would place the root by midpoint rooting procedure, by some other procedure, anyhow containing the likely position of the root, separates a subset of bacterial amino acid tRNA synthetases with a certain specificity from the archaea, eukaryotes, and another subset of bacteria. And in particular, there is this strong grouping between the vertebrate enzymes, in this case represented by the human sequence, and a particular group of bacteria, even placing the yeast homolog outside this group. So this tree topology is most likely explained by at least one, and probably more, horizontal transfers between eukaryotes and bacteria. we are not entirely sure in this case about the direction. Either direction would do the trick or would produce this topology. And a similar kind of topology over the different subset of bacteria is seen, say, in this tree. Note that in each of these cases, since we have complete genomes of all organisms involved, we can say that this is the only form of this protein. In other words, not only the evolutionary history of these enzymes involves, or in all likelihood, horizontal gene transfer, it also involved what may be called xenologous displacement of the ancestral gene by a horizontally invading gene.
So the horizontal invading gene, because of that, the organism has no use for the original gene. Is that what's
different? You have to remember that these are essential enzymes, indispensable. You cannot live without them. You can live without some form of that enzyme, okay? The sequence of events is very clear here. First, acquisition of a foreign enzyme through horizontal transfer. Then, because the acquired enzyme confers some selective advantage, and in some cases, we actually seem to understand what is going on. Like, for example, in this case. Because this eukaryotic enzyme makes these bacteria resistant to a particular antibiotic. And probably this is the selective advantage. Because of the existence of such selective advantage, the original form is subsequently lost. But apparently there is a transient moment in evolution, transient phase rather in evolution, or when these coexist in the same genome. And just to another couple, I guess the last couple of phylogenetic trees for these aminoacylterase synthetases, to bring home this point once again that there even in this class of enzymes, in at least one case for lysine, there are two types of completely unrelated aminoacyl-tRNA synthetase. And to make things more interesting, for at least one of them, we clearly show two evidence of two independent horizontal transfers between archaea and bacteria. So, I wanted also to talk about this lineage-specific gene family expansion, but I don't think we have really time for that, and we may not even have the strength for that. So let me just skip these slides and go to some conclusion. This I will show for a moment. This is just not to absorb all the details, but to illustrate just two points. That for, I think we have reached the stage with genome comparisons, where we can reconstruct in reasonable detail the evolution of certain functional systems. In this particular case, we are doing that to the system of programmed cell death, so-called apoptosis, which is central to eukaryotes in terms of their development, to multicellular eukaryotes at least, in terms of their development and the pathogen and stress resistance. We can reconstruct in considerable detail different stages in the evolution of such systems and link them to particular nodes of the evolutionary tree. And most importantly, it seems, from the study of the distribution of different domains and proteins that of which the system is composed, that horizontal gene transfer, probably from a particular group of bacteria such as actinomycetes, has substantially contributed to the evolution of this quintessential eukaryotic system. So to conclusion, by way of conclusion, let me just flash this slide that shows you a brief history of life as we viewed from the vantage point of proteins and protein domains as we see it now, starting with the gray areas of emergence of ribozymes and the early RNA world, preceding to the invention of a variety of domains, particularly nucleotide binding and nucleotide hydrolyzing domains, still at the RNA world stage.
Is the ribosome coming in at the second level?
Yes, the ribosome definitely comes in within the RNA world, probably in the first place is an RNA ribosome. You know that actually we have significant remnants of this in the functioning of the modern ribosomes, where peptide transfer reaction itself is pretty much catalyzed by RNA. With about 100 or somewhat more ancient folds already having emerged by the time of the existence of this last universal common ancestor. The subsequent evolution, including emergence of DNA replication in bacteria and archaeukaryotic lineage separately, the invention of lineage-specific domains, particularly early in eukaryotic evolution, through certain processes that may be already partially decipherable. And through further ahead to further evolution of complexity in eukaryotes through domain accretion, shuffling, and lineage-specific family expansions. Of course, it is just a sketchy picture, but I think it's a useful scaffold to fill in the details, and to some extent we are already capable of doing so. Just some folks from my group who made significant contributions to the studies that I tried to describe to you today, in particular Aravind, whose contribution to all the analysis of the protein universe that I was talking about are most important. And a part of my group in front of the model of an old alpha helical protein near a building in the Bethesda campus, which I guess is supposed by the unknown architect, was put there by the unknown architect to illustrate the alpha helical explosion at the onset of eukaryotic evolution. Thank you very much.